This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 22nd of September 2015 on Monocle 24. Section D on Monocle 24 in association with Squarespace. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. In this episode, we'll be poring over some prized properties with two men who've built an intriguing business selling modernist and contemporary homes.
I think it's only with proper context and being able to look back on something through slightly rose-tinted spectacles that we can get excited about something, and that's why, you know, the 60s and 70s, 60s particularly, I think is very praised at the moment.
And from the home to the garden, we'll be travelling to Köln in Germany to attend the world's largest garden design trade show. Here, a new generation of European makers are challenging the tide of cheap imports from abroad.
I think we have a fantastic opportunity as a young company to build a well-known brand, because there are not that many.
Plus, we hear tell of London's ever-growing design festival, which kicks off this week. All that to come today on Section D with me, Josh Fennett. First up, though, we'll get a taster of what to expect from this year's London Design Festival. These celebrations are bigger than ever, with one of the hubs located in the palatial surroundings of Somerset House on the River Thames. To launch Monocle 24's coverage of the festival, the team was out in force on Monday and chose the stand of Swiss manufacturer Punkt to anchor a live version of Midori House. Monocle's one and only Robert Bound spoke to Punkt founder Petter Nebby to find out more about its Jasper Morrison-designed MP01 mobile phone.
The mobile phone is our fifth product, the fifth product that comes in, and probably more clearer communicates what Punkt are doing.
This is very much kind of like your flagship product then, I
suppose. Absolutely, yes.
Tell us a little bit about the history of Punkt, because, you know, it's not like you're a company that was formed 6 months ago and you have five products. We were saying before we went on air, actually, that every company that's 2 years old has 500 products, just to make sure they're scrambling around into every single market that they can get their hands on. It's not a great sign of confidence often. So tell us about when you guys were born and why you only have five products, why this is only the fifth.
Right, first of all, you know, we are very serious about our products. That means that we don't want to make just a product for product's sake. Mm. And we have built and structured our organization in that way that we can afford to do so. So quite agile in creating partnerships rather than fixed costs. So that's sort of on the basis of an organization for doing so. So there is no true demand for just, you know, you have to go out there because you have to make a living. That's one part. You know, a company like Punkt, we have to do meaningful things. And it starts from meaningful, you know, purposeful business, so to say. And even though it's consumer electronics and there are, so to say, beautiful objects, I think very many people actually do appreciate a lot of the aesthetics of these products. Behind that, though, there is a very strong mission of the overall idea of what Punkt is about, and that is really about giving people's instruments to control and manage a little bit more technology. Today we are a little bit overtaken and we are more steered by technology than us steering technology. So therefore, about time then, and the long time it takes to make product that are meaningful, has some kind of purpose, and also are actually beautifully to look at and hold in their hand, takes a long time.
Yeah, and this is the idea as well, presumably, that, you know, you've made a product here with your first mobile phone, the first Punkt mobile phone, that actually sort of takes options away from people. It makes people have conversations in real life, because you can't have them on WhatsApp, presumably. You can't have an Instagram account when you're on this. You can't be on Facebook or Twitter. The idea is that you're giving people some time to actually have proper conversations and use their mobile phone to send a text, to phone their wife, to converse.
Yeah, yeah.
So I mean, we tend to think that good design is that comes from necessity. You know, it's necessity is the mother of invention and all the rest of it. So really, you've invented technology that takes us away from technology.
Yes. Well, technology is supposed to be there servicing us. Yeah. And I think technology is great. I think technology is doing, you know, fantastic things for humankind. You know, really. And I am 100% for, you know, all technology that can do that. And I think, for instance, the center of today's distraction, for instance, is the smartphone. It's a beautiful piece of technology, has so many qualities to it. But the problem today is probably we have sort of been taken with the pants down because we haven't really have any social structure or how to deal with such a powerful thing that sits now in on every table or in the pocket, meaning that it's really more, we get these pushes of push information to us all the time. We have lost the ability to focus and do one thing because it's the endless set of attraction that sits in this squared or rectangular piece of technology. So yes, I think, again, as you said, you know, for me, technology is there to service us, but we are currently, in a way, servicing technology.
Well, we're addicted to it. You know, people are always, you know, reaching for their back pockets as soon as their bus isn't immediately at the bus stop. They have to wait 30 seconds or something. Not in London. people are searching to, you know, to play a game or to find out what's going on. And this is presumably what you're not doing. But when does this idea of good design, being able to encourage conversation and interaction in real life, when does that stop becoming a nostalgia act?
First of all, it starts from what you set out to be doing with a product. I'm very concerned about being perceived as nostalgic because I think I'm the most modern consumer electronics company in the world. We got this piece of technology in our pockets now. We thought that can do anything. You can switch on your microwave oven, or you can monitor your children's behavior, etc. I think now we are at the stage where, okay, we had it for some time. Time to reconsider. It's good for a lot of things, not for everything. However, we as modern human beings, we need certain instruments, as I call them. Just because we are grown up with them, we need them, and it actually serves us, where you take charge of doing something rather than it comes to you and says, look at me, you know, I'm wanting to have your full attention. So I think that's why we shouldn't be or should not ever be perceived as nostalgic or reproduction kind of product company, because that's the intention of these products.
That was Robert Bound there, speaking to Petter Nebbe, founder of Swiss manufacturer Punkt, at the London Design Festival, which runs all this week. Expect more from the London Design Festival on next week's Section D. You're listening to Section D with me, Josh Fennett. Housing is always a hot topic in London, but wading through most websites and supplements might lead you to believe that thatched cottages and Georgian rectories were all the market had to offer. Enter The Modern House, a website and property selling platform that showcases the UK's most desirable and design-minded homes. For a decade now, former design writers Matt Gibbard and Albert Hill have helmed the remarkable firm, specialising in contemporary and modernist abodes. I caught up with the pair to find out more about the company, how it chooses what houses make the cut, and more about the booming modernist property market.
What are we now, 10 years old, and the landscape's changed a lot in those 10 years, in, you know, both in the property and the architecture sort of industries, which is where we cross over. I was a journalist writing about architecture and design many years ago, as was Matt, and I really just saw the niche because there are lots of owners of very interesting houses that were struggling to find the right people to sell them, and a lot of people who wanted to buy these things and were struggling to find out where to buy them. So that seemed an obvious thing to do, really. I mean, I'd like to claim it was completely original idea, but there was a company in America doing a similar sort of thing out there at the time. So I went out to Florida, in fact, to America to spend some time with them and sort of imported the idea, really.
And we're huge fans of the website, and there's an eminent shedload of very covetable houses and properties. Mm-hmm. I wonder if I could direct the question towards Matt, how you guys go about sourcing these properties and the work that goes into, you know, securing having these on your website rather than somewhere else.
Yeah, sure thing. I mean, when Albert and I first started the company, we got hold of a lot of magazines, architecture mags. We trawled the interweb as much as we could, trying to find houses and flats that we thought had some kind of design integrity to them. And then we set up a database, and that now has about 10,000 properties on it. And that's our kind of market. That's what we feel, you know, the houses and flats on there, we feel are ones that we would represent. And these days, really, you know, 60% of our work comes through word of mouth. We do quite a lot of direct marketing, making sure that the right people, the right owners know about what we do. A lot of our work comes through architects, as you can imagine. And a lot of it comes through press coverage, because I think we're quite lucky in the sense that we have very editorial-worthy houses, and a lot of the Sunday supplements are quite good to us. They come to us regularly because they've got 1,000,001 Georgian rectories, but perhaps not so many interesting modern houses for their pages. So those are the main routes, really.
Could you maybe tell me a little bit about the book, Albert? As we sit here, you guys are celebrating a much-deserved milestone, and maybe that's a good time to look back on some of the more interesting properties you've dealt with, or to consolidate the knowledge you have before moving forward. But, you know, as a printed product, what can we expect? And maybe you could introduce us to some of the kind of features in the book.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, I think that over the past 10 years, I mean, Matt and I have been very privileged to go into some of the best, most amazing houses in the UK. Not only us, but our photographers as well. So obviously, when we sat there for 10 years, we were flicking through our archive, and there were some really amazing shots there that a lot of people just wouldn't have had access to. So it was a very natural thing to pick out the best. And we did some pretty ruthless editing, didn't we, Matt? There's a lot more we could have had in there, but really it's just the sort of greatest hits of the past 10 years from a house called High and Over, which many people think is the sort of first modern house in the UK, which is in Buckinghamshire, right up to, you know, a David Adjaye place in London that was designed just a few years ago. And, you know, we've tried to get a mixture of, you know, one-off houses and sort of amazing conversions of industrial buildings. And the sections we've got, what are the sections we've got, Matt?
Well, there's townhouse, country house, yeah, conversion and apartment. So we also cover off the, you know, the really great modernist apartment buildings like High Point up in Highgate, the Isocon in Belsize Park, through the Barbican. I mean, to be honest, it was interesting going through the archive, because I think we could have produced probably three or four of these things when we thought about it. And we keep thinking of other houses that we quite like to have had in there. Maybe there'll be a part two in another 10 years. But there is an incredibly rich architectural history in this country that I don't think people really were very aware of. And, you know, we're quite pleased to be able to highlight that to people. And the book is about expressing our excitement at discovering these things to the outside world, and hopefully giving them a bit of a taste of what we've found while peeping over hedges and going to visit people.
So a decade's a long time for a company, and a book is an apt way to celebrate that. Mm-hmm. I wonder what we can expect from the next decade.
Let's face it, we couldn't have envisaged these last 10 years. So I think, you know, at the moment we're trying to concentrate very, very much on, as I say, building up what we do and taking any business opportunities that we can with the existing business model. You know, you talked about the new build market, for example. It is really interesting that the larger developers have, almost to a man, started knocking on our door in the last 3 or 4 months, I would say. I think that's partly because of the perception of the company and the way that we are. We recently redesigned the website, and I think there's more of a sense of scale now, and I think people can see that we're not necessarily just about the one-off product. I think there, you know, we have a huge audience, and therefore we can sell a large number of the same thing, and we can sell things off plan as well if they are packaged in the right way and if they're well designed.
I think what's interesting is that over the past sort of few years, people have really rediscovered all the kind of 50s and 60s architecture of the UK. Things like the Span Estates down in Blackheath, which is kind of iconic 50s and 60s architecture, and people are going absolutely crazy for it, and prices have rocketed percentage-wise over the past decade. But still, for instance, 70s and 80s architecture, people are still a little bit, you know, maybe. But I'm sure that in 10 years' time, people will be getting excited about those, you know. So
I think that's right. I think it's only with kind of proper context and being able to look back on something through slightly rose-tinted spectacles that we can get excited about something, and that's why, you know, the 60s and 70s, 60s particularly, I think is very praised at the moment. We actually kind of think that the, you know, some of the more postmodern stuff may have its day relatively soon. And the joy of our business is that there are new people doing new, exciting things every day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the good thing is we represent late 20s, early 30s, all the way up to the present day. So there's never going to be a shortage.
That was me speaking to Matt Gibbard and Albert Hill, the founders of The Modern House, a little earlier. And for a beautifully bound compendium of the Winsome website's Best Bits, a book chronicling The Modern House's first 10 years, is released late this September.
Great design tells stories, and Squarespace's innovative website building tool is the perfect platform from which to tell them beautifully. Showcase your creativity, ideas, and business in style with Squarespace's unrivaled range of online products and services. To see how it could work for you and for a 10% discount, head to squarespace.com and enter the promotion code Monocle. Squarespace. Build it beautiful.
You're listening to Section D with me, Josh Fennett. And now, especially for our green-fingered listeners, we hear from a growing section of the design world. That is, of course, the garden furniture sector. Monocle's Marie-Sophie Schwarzer met the designers and innovators at this year's Spoger & Gaffer Garden Fair in Cologne. Here, the world's leading international exhibitors displayed everything from grills to garden furniture and ornamental owls to plant bulbs. Marie-Sophie meandered through the latest outdoor furniture trends, met a few European manufacturers bent on beating the Chinese market, and found out why versatility is a watchword for furniture brands bringing their gardenware into the home.
This year, summer came to a close with another eventful edition of the world's leading international garden fair, Spoger & Gaffer in Köln. Over 3 days, 2,024 exhibitors showcased the latest trends in everything, from outdoor furniture to plants and garden equipment, at the expansive Köln Messe, to the joy of 37,000 trade visitors from around the globe. We spoke with Katharina Hammer, Chief Operating Officer at Köln Messe, to get an overview of this year's edition.
This is the biggest trade show in the world for this segment of the industry and also for this kind of leisure that you can have. We do have round about more than 2,000 exhibitors this year coming from nearly 60 countries, and more than 80% of these exhibitors are coming from outside Germany, so that really gives an indication about the international key role that this trade show plays in the world.
What are the highlights of this year's fair? What are you really excited about?
First of all, we have adapted a bit our floor plan because we wanted to follow also the developments of the industry. We do have increased the sector of the barbecue session, because barbecue is not only a summer trend anymore, it's an overall year trend, and it's tremendously increasing this market, and this is also what we have here on the exhibition site. Then we do have also a strong focus on furniture, all the design that you have in furniture. We do notice that the outdoor garden is becoming more and more an outdoor living room. And it's not only furniture, but also the decoration, the lightening of this outdoor room becomes more and more important.
We also met the brands and makers whose garden furniture collections made a lasting impression. First, we meet Lars Hue, founder of the 2007 established Danish outdoor design brand Hue.
I started the company because in Denmark we have a lot of talent in design, and they are very, very good and very exciting to work with. So when I started the company, it was because I couldn't help it. I needed to work with the fantastic Danish designers. And what we're doing now is we're working with a guy called Henrik Petersen and Jesper K. Thompson. We think it's the best designers in Denmark. They are not like hot name designers. They're just doing the job fantastic. I think in general, furniture, and especially garden furniture, is not moving that much. And I think we have a fantastic opportunity as a young company to build a well-known brand, because there are not that many. So if you went into fashion, you're going to struggle as a small Dane. But in garden furniture, is doing something that you really mean, it's going to succeed. What we have done, we have invented a plastic lamella that you can click on and off the chair. So you are able to build your own chair, you are able to rebuild your chair. We have done that together with a Lego, former Lego employee. So we have built a masterpiece of plastic, which is a part of our brand building today.
And then you use bamboo as well, which is planted in China. Could you tell us more about your decision and what led to that?
Well, we think it's to find nice wood for outdoor and still taking care of environment is very difficult. Bamboo is actually doing it. So we have complete control over where it's produced, and we know that it's helping the environment more than harming it.
Switzerland's Schaffner is taking the concept of sustainability to another level. Here to tell us more about the company and his signature Ricci chair is third generation Martin Schaffner.
We are producer of garden furniture in Switzerland since now the third generation. We are over 60 years old, long tradition. We are a small company with about 30 people, and we are very proud we produce everything in Switzerland. That's a very traditional Swiss chair. It's made with ish wood around from our company, 5 kilometers around the company. It's the wood made from in old handicraft type, made from one, he make sleds in the winter. And the steel is made in our company. It's really a lot of handicraft work, handmade. Anyway, we give 5 years warranty on anything.
And this is the most important fair for you?
Yes, it is. It is. It's the main fair for the German spoken languages and also for our customer in Switzerland. Everybody comes here and it's very important for us, yes.
Our next stop is 1990 established German furniture brand Jan Kurz, which showcased a collection of tables and benches from reclaimed wood, something we'll surely be seeing more of in the coming years. Founder Jan Kurz tells us more about his design philosophy and the latest garden furniture trends.
We like to keep it simple. So the design should be clear, should be one urban, young style, and with normally only natural material. This is the main attitude we have. The new trend, we think, will be that we have natural material which is already used and we can have a second use for the second life. So for example, we use old houses from oak, which is about, I think, 60, 70, 80 years old. So there's one history. We try to do nice tables of this old wood with a stylish design. And this is now the trend for the future, because we don't want to have too much products which is same looking like the other one.
Back to basics. That's where next year's outdoor furniture is headed, if it doesn't end up indoors. This year's real highlights were the simple pieces made close to home that will endure for generations to come. For Monocle, in Köln, I'm Marie-Sophie Schwarzer.
And to end the show, we turn to the world of retail. Sydney-based fashion label Jack and Jack was founded by Jacqueline Hunt and Lisa Dempsey, who opened their first international store in London's Soho earlier this year. The compact, gently lit space on Great Windmill Street is the perfect place to show the label's signature pieces, often made from natural fibres, including cashmere and Australian superfine merino wool. Jacqueline and Lisa were in town for London Fashion Week, which is on now, and met Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco to discuss their new shop and more about the brand.
Well, Lisa and I used to work in fashion companies in Australia together, and I think we travelled the world together sourcing and buying different products, and that's a lot of time on aeroplanes and in airports. So we got to talking about the market and where we saw that there could be a potential gap, and over the years we refined it down to its form now, which is our brand Jack and Jack, which is based in sort of quality, modern, kind of contemporary wardrobe pieces. And at the time in 2004, it was sort of missing in the market. It was very embellished and lots of overworked pieces, not overworked, but, you know, highly decorative. So we wanted to do something very minimal and very high quality with a lot of integrity. And that was the beginning of it.
And why London as your first international store?
That's a good question. It's also why not? You know, it's an international city and it's an exciting city. I think, you know, over many years, both Jack and I having travelled, you know, in and out of London in the last too many years. No, not too many years. It's diverse. Culturally, it's rich. You know, it's a main port for many other parts around Europe. So we travel here a lot ourselves. We love London. And I think there's a place, and I do hope there's a place for our brand. So far we're feeling like there's definitely potential here. We're starting to see some returning customers, and you know, I think London is very good on the high street and exceptionally, you know, remarkable on the luxury end as well. I think for a brand like ours that's, you know, very much focused on quality and wearability, this effortless, relaxed style, I think we have something to offer here. And, you know, it's not available everywhere. It's not on the high street, and it's not out there in a big way. It's good for us to test the market here too and go direct to our customers and get a sense of what they're after and where we fit in the market as well.
Let's talk a little bit about the product itself. I mean, you know, as you mentioned, it's something that you don't find easily on high street. I mean, who are the makers of those clothes as well?
We've got a really diverse sourcing base, which my team, myself in particular, you know, I'm really involved with. So we make all over the world. And what we do is we try and source best practice. So we look for the best cottons or the best superfine merino wool or the best cashmere. And then we also source the makers according to where they are. I've just been in Hong Kong and I'm working with an Italian spinner that buys all his cashmere from Mongolia, and he's based there, and he just produces incredible quality cashmere. So that's where we're getting our cashmere from. Superfine merino wool from Australia. We do a lot of knitwear. I also spend a lot of time in India. We're really into hand woven products as well. We do a selection of beach towels, which is hand woven. We also do beautiful cashmere shawls. So we work directly with the artists in Srinagar in Kashmir. We do a dyeing program, which is all hand-dyed natural dyes, which we do out of Jaipur in Rajasthan. So we like to really go to the source. It's kind of like who's growing. It's like a chef, you know, who's growing the best tomatoes. Great, we'll go and see that producer or whoever's, you know. That's how we approach our clothing.
And finally, what's next for Jack and Jack?
Well, we're definitely talking to a few other retailers and online, key online retailers. We'd like to work with a handful of partners on a long-term partnership. What we do is very sort of slow and considered, and that's always been our philosophy. So we're not looking to break into the world, take over the world.
Not this week anyway.
You know, enjoying the journey along the way and building long-term partnerships is really what it's about, longevity and integrity.
We would like to open more stores in London, not in probably the next year, but we can see a real future here, and we'd really like to probably open one or two more stores. And I think we're really keen to do that in other international cities as well, but I think that's further down the track, but I think that's definitely in the back of our mind.
That was Monocle's ever fashion forward, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, speaking to Jacqueline Hunt and Lisa Dempsey of Sydney-based label Jack and Jack at their new London store. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this episode of Section D with me, Josh Fennett. We will, however, be back at the same time next week. And if you missed any of this week's show or just fancy brushing up on our back catalogue, you can, of course, head to monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes to listen again. As usual, today's show was sprucely produced by David Pleasant and elegantly edited by our very own Alex Funnell. You can also contact the show's producer, David, at dmp@monocle.com with any comments, queries, recommendations, or suggestions. As always, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.